guess we'll open it up to questions and answers, comments, thoughts.
How far back for you does the work in this book go? Like, I think I read something where one of the pieces is, you know, very early in some sense.
Well, pieces in the sort of early part of the book, the first section, an outtake from the ideological origins of the American Revolution, was a story that I wrote the first drafts of when I was in graduate school. So it goes back to 97, 98, and then I published it in 99 in a literary journal, Agni. So that's the oldest of the stories. But I've had, it's interesting, I was thinking at several points, and I think I said this in, wonderful, one of my favorite people, Tanya Foster, is in the audience, and we were having a conversation for Bomb Magazine, and I believe I said this, I don't know if this made it into the interview, that at first when I was talking about this book in public conversations, I kept thinking, you know, I conceived it in the late 90s, but then I actually found a notebook from the early 90s where I actually had an idea for something like this, but of course I didn't know how to make it work. So it took a while to figure out.
Tanya? One of the most sort of stunning things in this book is the language, right? And the way that even the story that you just read moves between poetry and prose. Could you talk a little about the relationship between poetry and prose for you as a writer of both?
That's a tough question. I tend to see the two as closely related, but I think I also think there's a kind of used to fascinate my and dismay my literature classes and creative writing classes because I'd always draw these Venn diagrams on the board, you know, the two intersecting circles. And I'm like, is this a math class or science class? Or is this a literature class? But I see them as these sort of discrete entities that for me do connect in certain places. And when I write prose, I am as interested in the language itself as I am in the content of the story. So that, I think, comes from a deep interest in, you know, the sort of poetic possibilities of language. Because I think, you know, language can do so much just through sound, right? Just through word choice, just through syntax. But I'm also interested in, and I think, I hope it was clear in this book, that I'm also interested in telling stories, in narrative, right? And of course, one of the stories here is really, it's a novel. It's a novella. We call it a novella, but it is a novel. But even in that one, I realized there were points where, you know, I mentally, as I was writing it, I was sort of zooming in down to, like, the smallest sound, the smallest morpheme, you know, and then, of course, at other times, in my head, kind of keeping this larger story intact to move it forward so there would be action and drama and the characters would come to life, so.
How do you feel, I'm not sure how to ask this question, but how do you feel, like, has the work changed for you in the political moment that we're in?
That's a great question. I was thinking, actually, there's a way in which this book both, I think, directly and indirectly talks about what's happening now. I mean, one way of describing this book is, and I think someone did say this in a review, you know, one way you could say this is, I think maybe it was Barnes & Noble Review, this very much is a book about Black Lives Matter, right? Even though most of the stories, except for the final one, take place well before our current moment. But in a sense, they sort of talk about the for life of where we are today in the United States, and not just the United States, in the Western Hemisphere and across the globe, without directly commenting on, without directly narrativizing what's happening today. But I think the book, I think the things that are happening today were happening in different ways when I was younger. They were happening in different ways when I was born. They were happening in different ways, but similar ways to when my parents were growing up and children and grandparents and great-grandparents. So in a sense, I see there being a continuity, and I think this book very much is speaking to what's happening today even if, you know, it's the stories are set in certain cases 4 centuries ago or even just a century ago.
Speaking of that final story, which is really quite phenomenal, but the language there was so powerful and strong, and the situation was so strong that I wasn't. I mean, what I'm feeling is that a tyrant is being interrogated,
mm-hmm.
and he's being detained,
mm-hmm.
and interrogated by someone, and isn't and doesn't speak for a while,
mm-hmm.
And then eventually joins the discussion,
mm-hmm.
And so there it does kind of meld over into a dialogue. And when I was reading it, I was trying to like spot the tyrant, and I kept thinking, well, maybe it's him, or maybe. Then I decided it was sort of a kind of not a generic tyrant,
mm-hmm.
but kind of a tyrant larger than any one tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
And then vis-a-vis you're saying that one is Europe today.
Mm-hmm.
Is there are you playing with some themes of tyranny and because the interrogator also almost sometimes seems like he's in training,
mm-hmm.
The way he's kind of giving a little of what's going on in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed like this wonderfully complicated scenario where it's not all good over here and all bad over there, but it's this kind of intricate kind of malevolence, kind of speaking to everything at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of what's going on?
Yeah. No, I think you've got it. I think you've got it. I mean, one of the things I was really concerned about with that story, so I'll say several things. First of all, I didn't want it to be too abstract. So there's very concrete things in there.
Yeah.
But I didn't want it to be focused on one particular person because, of course, you know, you could just go down the list. I mean, you know, Mugabe or Siad Barre, Idi Amin, or all these characters. Right? And of course, I also have said, you know, of course, because I'm interested in, you know, particularly for that story for Africa, but I feel like, you know, there are analogs all over
sure.
the globe, right? You know, including in this country, right? You know, so I want to be clear about that. But yeah, I mean, I think part of what I was interested in is to think about how the first two sections of the book mark this movement from early modernity to modernism, right? Which is also the sort of moment in which, you know, slavery really kind of gains power, becomes this global, you know, system. Capitalism, of course, also gains power. The two are deeply intertwined. Black bodies and brown bodies are part of this system. And how we move into modernity, you know, thinking after the Age of Reason, et cetera. So what is one result when we think of today? And so part of what's happening in that final story is that you see both rationality and, you know, sort of unreason coming to the fore. And there is, it is an interrogation, although someone pointed
it's
out.
It's an exchange.
It's an exchange.
A strange exchange.
Because part of what's also being, I think, expressed is what happens when ideals curdle, when ideas and ideology become so potent and so powerful that it just becomes a tool for destruction and for, you know, self-enrichment, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And what have we left in the wake? We had this long journey into the present day, and now what? Mm-hmm. Right? You know, just so we can, as one of the characters says, you know, your kid, basically, your kids, hey, one child is living in Atlanta, and the other person is living in Switzerland, the other person's in L.A., you know, they've got, you know, everything they want, but what? You know,
yeah.
what's the ultimate goal? So, but then I would say this one person actually pointed out, and I kind of thought about this, but then it was wonderful just to have a reader sort of say this, that this also could be a dialogue by a single person,
mm.
right, having a kind of debate with himself
right.
About how things had gone so wrong.
Mm.
So which also, I think, kind of, makes it even stranger and more disturbing in a certain way. But yeah, it's a great, great point. Yes.
I have a question about Bob Cole. So he went crazy, or he...
Yes.
Yeah, he like had a psychotic breakdown or something?
Yes. Well, it's not, I mean, I actually, when I heard the story of his death, that he drowned himself in Catskill Creek, the creek up in the town of Catskill, I was really curious. So I said, let me write the story. This is what I try to do, is I try to write as much as possible. And before I do too much research, because I don't want to be totally guided by the research. And then I said, okay, well, let me just actually check to make sure I haven't totally, because you know, the basic things like, you know, if you're going up to Catskill, New York in 1912, do you take the train to Grand Central Station, or do you take the train to Pennsylvania Station, right? You know, I mean, because I think they both existed at that point. So I, you know, little things like that I wanted to figure out. So I found in the newspapers different descriptions about, you know, the famous composer Bob Cole. You know, he was in the institution for the insane in New York. He had gone up to Catskill, sort of. I don't know if he signed himself out, or that wasn't clear. But he was let out, and then he drowned himself. But none of the accounts gave any sense of why he would have taken this terrible act, because he was actually quite famous. He was quite wealthy for the time, I mean, because his shows were extremely successful. And his songs, as I said, I mean, you know, were being played well into the, deep into the 20th century. So I wanted to imagine what might make him take this step? And then I also thought, it's something to be able to think of a song, a poem, anything just off the top of your head. Or you can hear a snippet of something, like a little snatch of music, and just transform it into something else. Right? Some people have that gift. But what happens if you can't turn it off? Then it becomes oppressive. You start to drown in the music. So then that made me think I could connect that drowning in the music to drowning in the water, right? Because in a sense, that would be the one thing that would shut it off. So. Yes.
So you started this project a long time ago. So was your original intent, and then by the time it was finished, like how had that changed, or had it changed, or you know, what was the process starting and then ending, since it was such a long period of time?
Well, part of it, I had this idea that I was going to finish this project by like 2005, 2006. So one of the stories involves the Haitian Revolution, and a friend of mine who's Haitian American, was compiling this book of works, sort of tributes to the Haitian Revolution, the 200th anniversary in 2004. And I was like, I've got to get you this story. It's going to be the best story in the book. You know, I was just so excited. And of course, so this is a warning to everyone. I know you all know this, but I'm just going to give this warning. Even though I tell my students to do this, I did not back about four or five stories up, and I did not print them out. I had notes, and my computer crashed, and I lost, some of the stories were already done, but I lost just huge, I mean, just draft, whole drafts. However, of course, when the computer was repaired, I tell people this is kind of funny, all of my school, all of my teaching files survive, right? All the tests and things like this, you know, syllabi. So it's like, you know, I don't know, maybe this was a sign. It's like, okay, now you need to focus on teaching. But anyway, so, but it meant that I had to reconstruct everything. And when I began reconstructing everything, I realized, you know, there is a way to make this all work, right? So I think it probably was a looser and freer and more open process for me when I really got going after I had to kind of redo things. But it took a few years. And then I had about maybe four stories, and there are 13 in here. And then over the period of 2 years, I wrote 9 more. So the stories, once they started coming, they really started coming. So then it was a pleasure. I mean, it was, of course, a strain every time I was going through the writing of each story. But once they would come and I would have drafts and I could correct them, it was a real pleasure. Yes. Maxine.
Another writer who works more with poetry than with fiction, but with both also, Nate Mackey.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you start? Did you start with the idea that you're going to, like, historically research culture in poetry or in prose, or how did the two line up for you, and how did you wind your path to where you arrived?
That's a great question. I think, well, with my first book, there's a lot of history woven in there, and I've always been interested in history. And I think with this book, when I was in graduate school, I wrote that first story, and that story came because I'd gone to this amazing workshop called Kaveh Khanum, and it's a workshop for Black poetry, and there were people doing all kinds of poetry. Any kind you could possibly think of, they were doing it, right? Fixed forms, free verse, historical poems, very personal poems, long poems, short poems, okay. And one of the sort of challenges that we had was we were writing all these different kinds of poems. And so there was one workshop that I was in, and Elizabeth Alexander was teaching it, and Walter Mosley just came and sat in. And I was sitting next to Walter Mosley, and this might have been right after I graduated finished up my MFA. I was sitting there to Walter Mosley, and I sat there in that room in, like, however long it was, and wrote a complete poem, and then we had to share our poems with other people. Of course, I'm terrified because I have to share mine with, you know, this amazing writer. I mean, Walter Mosley is a really great writer, right? And I, you know, hand it to him, kind of embarrassed, right? And he looks at it and he says, "I think this is done, man. I think this is done," you know, like Walter Mosley does, right? So then I realized, okay, well, I could do a book of poems about my family and historical poems, right? Because there's still a lot of books like that that are beautifully, you know, beautifully done. But around the same time, I was reading, shortly before then, I was reading this book of history called The Negro in Colonial New England. And I kept coming across all of this information I'd never heard. And I lived in Boston for about 10 years. And I thought, this entire history is a race. So then I thought, what if I actually tried to write a story about some of this material? So I set the book aside. And then I think that was sort of one of the kernels. I mean, as I said, once earlier I had kind of envisioned something along these lines, but I didn't know how to pull it off or how to proceed. But then I thought, maybe it would be really interesting to do it as short stories, in part because it allows you, I mean, poetry, you can do so many amazing things, but in short stories, you know, you can really sort of or novels, right? You can dramatize these lives. You can really bring people into these stories in ways that I wasn't sure I could do in poetry. So that was what led me to go to the prose route. Yes.
If I wanted to ask a question, and you're from St. Louis, correct?
Yes.
I just kind of want, this is, that doesn't have maybe a lot to do with what you just read, but I'm kind of curious to hear about St. Louis and whether you have a relationship to that city still, or how it signifies in your life and in your art now.
Well, I think it's deeply, deeply here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we're the places where we were born, and I mean, sometimes, of course, people are born in one place and they grow up in a lot of different places. But I was in St. Louis. I was born there and grew up there and lived there till I was 18 years old. My mother's still there. My brother's still there. A lot of relatives still there. And it's deeply inside me. And St. Louis well, of course, now the entire world knows about St. Louis. You know, it's one of those places that was kind of forgotten. And then after, you know, the terrible situation in Ferguson and, you know, by extension, the entire St. Louis metro area. After all of that, now it's really in the public consciousness in a certain kind of way. But St. Louis is in me in the sense that, and sort of interests me in the sense that, and this was, I think I tried to convey this in my first book, St. Louis is both a northern city and a southern city. It is both an eastern city and a western city. It was might have been in the capital of Missouri, but it was like really at one point like a major industrial powerhouse, one of the major powerhouses in the country. And now, you know, then it went through this long period of decline. It really sort of tracks the industrial decline of the U.S., the kind of deindustrialization, you know, and the sort of changes in the economy, right? It's a city that's been riven by, on certain level, in certain ways it was actually progressive, in other ways it was very regressive. You know, so all of those things, I feel like, you know, like growing up there, you have a sense of all of this, even if you can't really sort of put words to it. And I think that that comes through in my work. And I felt like, you know, that always gives me, being from a place like St. Louis, it gives me license to sort of imagine other worlds, right? Because in certain ways, you know, there are parts of St. Louis, when you're there, it's almost like New Orleans. And other parts of Chicago, of St. Louis is sort of like Chicago. And other parts of St. Louis, I mean, you could be in Kansas. So, you know, all of that, I think, in a sense, kind of fuels my interest in trying to write and think about, you know, things beyond that place, but that's definitely deep, you know, deeply rooted inside me.
Thank you. Yeah. This is a question about what you said earlier about you didn't want the research to guide you,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of your historical research. And do you if research doesn't guide you, what guides you? And do you see that as a way of trying to counter dominant narrative, which is mostly historical narrative, or what are, can you speak on those kind of thoughts and your process and how you're managing history with your stories?
Mm-hmm. That's another great question. I mean, so part of what this book does, I think, is that it aims to, as the title says, really to produce counter narratives to the master narrative, master narratives that exist. I mean, even something like, even a kind of story that we all sort of know but don't really know, like the American Revolution. I mean, the American Revolution is much more complex. And so I was really interested, because most people don't have any idea that Massachusetts had slaves, right? Or that most of the northern states had slaves, right? New York had the largest number of, New York State, New York City in particular, had the largest number of slaves of any northern state. And it was either Connecticut or Rhode Island had the largest percentage. Connecticut, it's like one of the last places. So I was really kind of interested. So both countering those master narratives, but filling in the gaps that exist. So in a sense, this also is a kind of counter-archive, right? What might counter-archival work look like? On the other hand, when you write fiction, it's an imaginative enterprise. Right? I mean, I think there are people who, if you're going to hew strictly to the facts, then you're writing nonfiction. Right? You're writing biography, you're writing history, you're writing journalism. You're doing, you know, you're sticking to the facts and you're not going too far from the facts. With memoirs, I think one of the nonfictional forms where you have a certain amount of leeway. You know, you can move things around in a memoir and almost get away with it. But in fiction, you know, you have a lot of leeway. So, and you have the possibility, as filmmakers do, to kind of zoom in on things, zoom out, move things around, have pan shots, do all, you know. But you're doing it with language. Language is a tool. So, I think part of what I wanted to do was to give a tribute to history in this book, history as a field, historiography as a field. To get people to think about history, but I also wanted to critique history, and particularly the dominant approaches to history in this country. So there are a lot of subversive things in this book. I mean, one of the things that I think is so interesting, most people don't ever mention, is there are a lot of languages in this book. I mean, I have Chickasaw in here, and I think people are probably like, what the hell? Maybe they think it was a made up language, right? This is actually Chickasaw. I mean, what does it mean to have Chickasaw, right, this Native American language, in a book of 21st century American, African American literature? What does that mean? You know, what is it doing there? How does it signify? So those are things I'm sort of interested in, particularly when it comes to history and the archive.
Yeah, this too. One of the things that struck me on first reading the book, I've been recommended by Tom Concauter, first read Gloss. Mm-hmm. She said, read that, you know, and so I immediately started reading that story, which, you know, begins in Haiti during the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The woman is carried to remote Kentucky to a Catholic nunnery,
mm-hmm.
as a servant, and then the other stories were in Brazil,
mm-hmm.
and were across the Americas, and I love the way that it that the book doesn't confine itself to some kind of nationalism in some sense. You know,
right.
The story isn't just a United Statesian story, it's a particular aspect of it, but that it's the new world. It's the entirety of that, you know, from the North Pole on down, you know.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, just a beautiful thing about the book, that it opens up the way that including Chickasaw opens it up, including Brazil opens it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this is also our story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. That's a good comment. Yes.
I know you talked about what your interests are a lot already,
mm-hmm.
but I was just wondering if you could give us an idea of, like, boil down the idea of what really inspires you. Is it, like, iconic themes or, like, an area, or what really inspired you, like, not just for this piece, but, like, what's your muse, for example?
Mm-hmm. That's a really tough question. I mean, there are a lot of things. Pretty much, just, you know, the world around me. I'm really interested in the world around me. I mean, some people can take the things that they are encountering and process it very quickly. For me, I have to sort of think about them. I mean, sometimes, you know, there was a point where I was working a full-time job. I'm still working a full-time job, but I don't have to be in my office all the time, right? A different kind of full-time job, let me put it that way. And my only real breaks during the day came at lunchtime, and I would go during, you know, many of my lunchtime breaks, if I wasn't having lunch with my colleagues, and I'd go sit outside and write poems, write really short poems, often about observations and things like that, you know. And I realized, you know, that was a way for me to immediately process what I was experiencing or feeling. And it wasn't so much like, you know, personal things, but it's about the personal, but sort of also in conversation with the world. And I think that's still the case. So every story in here, I feel, you know, deeply attached to. You know, I was asked early on, what is your favorite story? And you can't say all of them. You know, no one wants to hear that. You know, they want to hear one. So I think I mentioned Gloss because it's the longest story and it's the most, most complex one. But then in other cases, when people have asked me, what's your favorite story? Or do you like this story? I say, yeah, I love that story. Because as I said, there's some of me in every one of these stories, but also they're not about me. They're about the world in interesting and different ways.
Been very generous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.